From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the night of April 26th this past spring. Five states voted in the Republican presidential primary that day, and it was another dominant night for Donald Trump. He was close to cementing victory in the Republican primary. And in his speech that night, Trump accused Hillary Clinton of, quote, playing the woman card. He went on to say that if she were a man, she would be a failed candidate. In her own speech, and then on Twitter, Clinton responded. Her account tweeted the following quote, borrowed from her campaign speech that night, quote, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in, end quote. Well, that phrase, the woman card and deal me in, became kind of the hot meme of the week in politics. And in the moment, it's hard to know who's getting the best of the exchange. But a team of researchers, including some from the University of Rochester, dove into the data. They believe their work has shown who has been winning the so-called gender card war on social media. And that's not all they've analyzed. They've studied some of the subject and issue preferences of Trump followers, for example. This is our monthly Science Roundtable, and it explores how social media is impacting national campaigns with Election Day tomorrow. My guests include Jaybo Luo, who is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Rochester. Jaybo, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Mike Johansson is the senior lecturer of communication at RIT and a social media consultant with Fixitology. Mike, nice to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
All right, Jaybo, I want to start with you. I go back to that April night. I remember well his comment that if Hillary Clinton were a man, she wouldn't even be in this race, et cetera, et cetera. And that sparked this back and forth, the gender card. I think the Clinton campaign actually printed real gender cards,
yeah.
I have one. Oh, you have one. Okay.
Yeah, my student bought one, and he gave me as a souvenir.
Okay. So they were trying to leverage this to their advantage. Trump was trying to continue this idea that she was just an identity politics candidate. And how did you decide, and how did your team sort of go into this research trying to figure out what was happening here?
So basically, we are interested in find out the effect of this women card issue on both candidates. So we have been tracking the Twitter followers of this candidate plus others like Sanders and Ted Cruz since September of 2015.
All right.
So we have over, I think each of Clinton and Trump has more than 10 million followers now. Okay, so what we find out is actually this issue definitely had a positive effect on Clinton's campaign. So as a result, she's losing fewer women supporters, and she's gaining more women supporters. So net-net, it's a gain for her.
What about on Donald Trump's side? The assumption would be if Hillary Clinton is gaining more female followers and supporters, and those who are following her are sort of affirming or strengthening their support for her, that this would be a zero-sum game and that Donald Trump may be losing women supporters and followers. Did you find that?
So we did find that that Donald Trump loses women followers. But what's more interesting is we look at the percentage of women followers Donald Trump lost and the percentage of women followers Donald Trump gained during that period from March to May. It turns out the proportion didn't change. So to us, the data suggests that the woman card had very little effect on Trump supporters, especially in women.
All right, so it was a measurable gain for Hillary Clinton, but
right.
Not a measurable loss for Donald Trump.
Correct.
Should I be surprised at that?
I think on the surface it's surprising, but there may be some possible explanations. For example, if some women decided they're going to support Trump, maybe they are already over such issues. So this event would have minimum impact on them, and as a result, Trump didn't lose more women because of this, he was still gaining women supporters at the same proportion.
You're saying people get very entrenched in their belief. Is that
that would be my easy explanation?
Yeah. Okay, I think that. That certainly tracks with what we have seen. Mm-hmm. In fact, last hour I had a clip of Rachel Maddow on her show on a different issue, but boy, I saw some comments she made today. Meghan Mack, maybe we can find this. If you go, it's about a minute and 50 seconds long, and it's Rachel Maddow talking about how if you look at the candidates' favorability ratings and several different ratings from January to today, Trump and Clinton, they have not moved more than a point. It's after everything that's happened this year, there's been almost no change. And one of the reasons Rachel Maddow saying is these are the two most well-known candidates going into a national election cycle in history. They're household names. There's not a whole lot new to learn about them, and that they just haven't moved in terms of likability, in terms of negative ratings, despite all of it. So I guess if we're looking at what happened with the so-called gender card or, you know, the women card this past spring, that would track with this idea that, well, Donald Trump is not going to be gaining or losing much support in terms of people know him. People have decided how they feel about him already.
That's what I think. We haven't done any deeper analysis to find other factors in this. So that's my explanation.
Okay. Mike Johansson?
Well, I have one question. I'm curious. Did you do a breakdown on male and female followers, supporters on Twitter beforehand? Because there's usually quite a discrepancy between the numbers of males and females.
Right. So we did. So we have the breakdown of male, female supporters. We also have breakdown of, black, white, Hispanic supporters. So what Evan and I have been talking about was that we saw the proportion of women supporters staying at the same level before and after the woman card event.
Yeah. I guess my question is, would Donald Trump have a lot fewer women supporters to lose in the first place?
I think...
And I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I think we didn't look at that, but we have that data. I think Donald Trump... I think I have data. Donald Trump does have fewer women supporters to begin with, but it's not like lopsided. We also find the same thing, which is somewhat surprising, that Donald Trump also enjoys support among African-American and Hispanic much more than what people think.
You mean in terms of the social media setting?
Twitter followers.
If
we look at the proportion, Clinton has higher proportion of black and Hispanic supporters. But it's not like Trump has one-tenth of hers. Trump has more than half of hers.
Okay. And I think some may say, Jaybo, that, well, they're following, but that doesn't mean they're supporting.
Right. So that's a valid question. So to address that issue, what we also do is we track likes in tweets or in Twitter. So if someone likes a Donald Trump tweet, that tells us he or she is a supporter rather than just a mere follower.
And I think that, Mike Johansson, is a very fair point that if you're following somebody, we follow all kinds of people we may not vote for. But if we're liking their tweets all day long, we're much more likely to be a fan.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're doing any kind of social media analytics, I mean, this is in business or anywhere, you're tracking not just likes, but then you're tracking resharing, and then tracking commenting and commenting on commenting. And the deeper you get, the more engaged someone is with that particular account.
Okay. Well, if you've got any questions on this research, or if you are someone who... I was going to say, if you're a woman supporting one of the candidates, if you're a man supporting one of the candidates, I'm going to ask Jaybo in a question in a moment if this incident with the gender card, did it strengthen male support on Donald Trump? I don't know if he knows the answer to that, but if you'd like to weigh in on this, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Some other subjects we're going to be getting to this hour include the sharing of fake news. The New York Times had a big story on this. Mike Johansson's been sort of beating a drum on this, on being careful with what you're sharing on Facebook, on Twitter, what's out there, how often it's wrong, and by the way, how often it's shared and reshared by people who should really know better. We're going to get to that coming up here, among other subjects in our monthly Science Roundtable as we're talking about social media and the elections. So Donald Trump made this comment about Hillary Clinton. He essentially says, if she were a man, she'd be a failed candidate. She is an identity politics candidate only. This was back in April. Does it help him with men, Jaybo? Do we know if that helped him with men?
I just checked my data. I think... it also shows no effect on men.
Okay.
Before and after. So it's the same proportion among followers and the same portion among unfollowers, meaning people who used to follow them but decided to abandon them.
Okay. And again, that could be traced to the fact that this is someone who was very entrenched with support or opposition by the time April and May roll around to begin with. So, okay. So, Mike Johansson, let's broaden this conversation to discuss the way we consume and the way we interact on social media to begin with. The candidates have very different approaches to this. Mm-hmm. President Obama had a little fun with Donald Trump over the weekend because apparently Donald Trump is not tweeting, and I guess his staff has maybe taken away some of his Twitter privileges, saying, come on, there's a few days to the election, don't blow this. The president had a little fun with that. For you, does it matter to you that when Donald Trump tweets, at least you're almost certain that it's him tweeting, whereas if it's Hillary Clinton, it's not actually her tweeting unless she's signing it with her initials? Does that matter?
I think it does in terms of transparency. And by the way, I do wonder what Donald Trump's now doing at 3 a.m, but I'm sure he found something else to do. But
yes.
I think it does matter. I mean, the best practice of social media, of course, is to be transparent. And if you have an account that's run by your campaign and you're only occasionally, this is what happens on President Obama's account. You know, he signs his personal tweets -BO,
yep.
And you know it's from him. I personally would like to see all people doing all their own personal tweeting. And if you have a campaign account, keep that separate. But, you know, there's time and they're busy people and so forth. I think it does matter to people, particularly younger voters. If you're going to follow an account, I've had students tell me, for example, that the tweets from President Obama, they don't pay too much attention to them, but they really pay attention to the ones that are signed by him. Because it's from his mind to your ear kind of thing.
I agree with that. I think Mike makes a very compelling point that if you're going to tweet as yourself and otherwise have a campaign or an office account. But at the very least, I think what Clinton and Obama and I think a number of other elected leaders in both parties do in terms of initialing the actual tweets from them, that is a lot better than simply not having a policy on that, and therefore your followers don't know if that's actually you tweeting, right, Mike?
Right, right. And then sometimes the only way of telling is tone of voice. You know, you sort of, oh, that clearly wasn't written by that person. They're never that nice on Twitter or whatever it is. I heard a great quote this morning, actually, on Morning Edition on NPR about how, you know, Twitter's a bit like the Post-it notes, but not on the refrigerator, but they're all over the kitchen floor. And it sort of brought, you know, and you sort of have to sift through them and figure out what's real and what's not real. Well, you know, I liken social media to the village square. You know, we're sort of going back to the village square where everyone can have an opinion, can share an opinion. But at least in the village square, you pretty much knew who to believe, who not to believe. You pretty much knew who knew the other people. Now you're in social media, there's vast village square, millions of people sharing things, most of whom you don't know personally. And most of the veracity of what they're saying cannot be checked instantly. You've got to take a little time. And that's where the problems begin.
Yeah, and I want to get to a phone call from Jared in Ithaca in just a second. Let me close the loop on this first bit of research that we're working through with Ajebo Luo, who is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Rochester. So if you're declaring a winner in the gender card war on social media, this one goes to Clinton?
Correct.
Okay, just because more of a gain in terms of followers and what appears to be supporters.
Yeah, more gain and less loss.
Okay, very good. Let me get Jared in Ithaca on the phone first up. Go ahead, Jared.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. I just want to make a brief comment on being a college graduate and encountering fellow college graduates online who are spreading what I guess we could call fake news, news that is not well-researched. And part of the advice I've been dispatching as a result is to treat their vote kind of like a term paper for a very strict professor. Really do your homework on what you're seeing and citing your sources and reading about the sources that are cited within the pieces that people are sharing and reading. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared, for that. And that's a great entry into this portion of the conversation. Fake news or unsourced or flat-out wrong information, the way it's shared. Before I kick it over to our panelists, let me just read from the New York Times. And Mike, this came from you. When was it? I actually don't know when this article was.
Today's paper.
It was from today.
Yeah.
All right, this is from the New York Times headline today. Media's next challenge, overcoming the threat of fake news. And here is one of the paragraphs from that story. Quote, "In the last couple of weeks, Facebook, Twitter, and other social media outlets have exposed millions of Americans to false stories, asserting that the Clinton campaign's pollster, Joel Benenson, wrote a secret memo detailing plans to salvage Hillary Clinton's candidacy by launching a radiological attack to halt voting, which was merrily shared on Twitter by Roger Stone, an informal advisor to the Trump campaign. That the Clinton campaign senior strategist John Podesta practiced an occult ritual involving various bodily fluids. That Mrs. Clinton is paying public pollsters to skew the results shared on Twitter by Donald Trump Jr. That there is a trail of supposedly suspicious deaths of myriad Clinton foes, which the Times' Frank Bruni heard repeated in a hotel lobby in Ohio. So all of those fake news stories recently not only making the rounds, but shared by Roger Stone, Donald Trump Jr. I think it's fair to say the Trump campaign and people close to the Trump campaign have been much more prone of sharing some of this nonsense that's out there. But a lot of people on all sides share stuff that is not true. Mike Johansson, how serious do you think this situation is with sharing fake news?
I think it's incredibly serious. And if there's some wealthy foundation out there that would like to fund me, I would gladly start a research institute into ways that we could solve this problem. I think it's a serious problem for democracy. The example of a few weeks ago, a Jordanian news service, Petra, was hacked. And a story was posted saying that the Saudi government was responsible for funding about 20% of the Clinton campaign. That story was very quickly shared by Breitbart and a few other conservative websites, and all of a sudden it's being quoted by political pundits from Fox and so forth. Of course, the danger of this is completely untrue, but it's also illegal in this country for foreign powers to fund election campaigns. But then you get people sharing it on Facebook and Twitter and so forth, and taking it as, well, it came from this news service. Well, it was on the news service because they were hacked, and the story was placed during the hacking, and it took, I think, about an hour before someone noticed the story was there and took it down. But at that point, screenshots and so forth. It's incredibly dangerous to a democracy because people should be doing their due diligence. And due diligence today is pretty much, well, it was shared by someone I know, therefore it's probably okay, share it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And listen, I'm sure I've done this. I hope not recently. But I'm sure I've had a moment where I'm so fired up about some such issue that I see a headline shared by somebody I know, just as Mike says, and I think, well, this person wouldn't share this if this were bunk. And I share it, and I eventually have to eat crow. And I have tried to pull myself back from doing that. And what Jared in Ithaca is saying, Mike Johansson, is that treat it like a term paper and vet it much more carefully. That would be a big cultural lift to get that changed in this country, to have more people who are stopping before sharing and vetting. Is it doable? Is that realistic?
Oh, I think so. In fact, there's never been such an effort for fact-checking. I did a blog post, I think you have a link to it somewhere, that looked at all the fact-checking opportunities you have today. There were two or three in the 2012 election. My rough count of the ones I could quickly find is over 20.
So, some examples?
Now, of course, you're going to call me on that right away when I don't have the page. I haven't turned to the page, of course.
Well, I've already put Jabo on the spot here.
Yeah,
so
right.
Turnabout is fair.
So, all right. So some big-name media outlets that you might consider a bit on the right. The Wall Street Journal and Forbes offer fact-checking. A few media outlets you might consider on the left, New York Daily News, Huffington Post. Mainstream media outlets, USA Today, ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS. Fact-checking organizations, PolitiFact, FactCheck.org, Snopes. Foreign news media that have fact-checking, BBC and Reuters. Hip media outlets have fact-checking, BuzzFeed, Heavy.com, MIC, Mike.com. Partisan advocacy organizations that do fact-checking. These are really partisan, but Breitbart, Newsbusters, and Think Progress, both left and right. So there's plenty of opportunity for fact-checking out there. Best case scenario would be to go to two or three fact-checking sites. Probably people aren't going to do that. But the simple thing is find a fact-checking site that you think is reliable and trustworthy. After you've been to two or three, and just keep hitting that one to check the veracity of what's being shared.
Listeners, when's the last time you saw someone that you know and love share something that you knew instantly was wrong? And what do you do about that? Do you shame them? I mean, there are times where I've probably deserved some shame. Do you try to call it out? And in general, I'm very curious to know if people are finding resistance. In other words, if someone shares something that you know is ridiculous, but they really believe in it, that they've got confirmation bias really infecting their brain on this one, are they willing to say, hey, thanks for that update, I'm wrong on this? I'd like to hear from you. 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In a minute, I'm going to ask the researcher in the room, Jebo Luo, to put on his research cap. If he were designing a research project to ask the question, how have incorrect or inaccurate news stories impacted the election shared via social media, how do you go about researching that? But Mike, let me ask you, you lecture on this subject. You talk to college students. I'm sure you've talked to younger students. Should social media teaching, should it start in middle school, high school, in various levels, not just fake news, but in terms of etiquette, understanding social media, understanding how news operates? Should we start teaching that at younger ages?
Oh, absolutely. And there are school districts in Monroe County that are already doing it. I have a colleague who has a fourth grader who brought home a note from the school talking about, we're going to be covering X, Y, and Z around social media. We just want to make sure that you're aware of this and you're okay with it.
Okay. And that's
fourth grade.
What do you think?
I think it's great. I think absolutely. I mean, part of being a good citizen is understanding the people around you, the world around you, what to take with a grain of salt, what to sort of politely nod and say yes, even though you disagree with them.
When to maybe push back.
When to push back, when to stand up for something that is really important for your own values, that kind of thing. And honestly, I don't think you can start too early on that.
This dovetails with my desire to see more schools teach, sort of epistemology, confirmation bias, the way we think and come to form beliefs at an earlier age. And that could go hand in hand with the way that confirmation bias impacts the way we use social media, what we share and why.
Yeah. And, people have said for quite some time now that social media is an echo chamber.
Yeah.
You're only connected to the people that you like and know, therefore you're only getting opinions from people you like and know. What's very interesting is the Pew Center for Research on the Internet and American Life actually came out with a study last year, 2015, that pointed out that that's not the case. People actually do get a wider variety of opinions than is generally thought they do. And they did it around the early stages of the elections in 2015.
Jebo, if you were putting together a research project that really wanted to examine the possible deleterious impacts of sharing news that's inaccurate on social media, how would you start?
Actually, incidentally, we actually done some work on coming up with automatic algorithms that will flag fake news, rumors.
And maybe we could work together when we get that $5 million grant.
I hope so. So I think it's an issue in social media everywhere, especially today when a lot of people, they don't actually go to mainstream media for news. They go to social media. So it's important, as talked about earlier, to have early education on how to treat the information you get from social media. But I just want to spend a few minutes to talk about our research. So we look at, we actually have the authorities, the news agencies, to flag a bunch of actually a large set of fake news data, so that we can use machine learning to train algorithms to differentiate the difference between fake news and real news. So we were moderately successful. And one thing I want to mention is today, I think in social media, you see the use of images everywhere. So one signature we use to differentiate fake news is, if it's fake news, it's possible, or most time, there's only one image, because it's hard. It's easy to fake text. It's very hard to fake images, or at least it takes a lot of effort. So you see this fake news around, and they can't come up with more than one image. But if it's a real event, then there are all kinds of witnesses, and they took pictures, and then you see a variety of images. So that's one of the cues we use to filter fake news.
Hmm.
Yeah, so this is the active project we're doing, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any idea for your timeline for this project, Jebo?
So I think it depends on what's considered acceptable, right? So if we want a 100% accuracy, that's a long shot. But what I believe is if this filter is, let's say we can 75% accurate, then I think it's useful. Mm-hmm. At least it serves as a mechanism to stop the spread of fake news.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me get to your phone calls. Danielle, first up, Danielle calling in Rochester. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I wanted to bring up, you know, they're talking about vetting the stories that are going through, and I want to bring it back one step. I had a friend of mine that has been very concerned about the killer clowns that have been happening, and she shared a news story that said that some clowns had killed a couple of children in Florida or something like that. And she commented on it, and there were a couple of other comments. Well, I clicked on the link, and on the other side of the link was a clown laughing and pointing at you, saying this is a fake news story. No one had even clicked on the link to read the article. So I took a screenshot of it, and I posted that in the comments and kind of gently reminded people to not believe everything they see on the Internet.
Wow.
So not just researching the article that you read, but once you've seen a headline, even if you don't read the article, what do you have to see something like 3 or 6 times before you just plain believe it, whether it's true or not? So that's my experience, and I think maybe we're giving people more than they deserve. Like, at the very least, click and read.
Yeah, well, Danielle, thank you for that. And Mike Johansson, that cannot be an outlier. I can't tell you how many times people will post a long-form article. I'm talking 8,000-10,000 words, and it's shared instantly. It's, you know, check out this story. There's no way you could have read the whole thing. There's no way. And what Danielle is describing is exactly in that vein. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And you... usually what it is it was a headline probably written as clickbait to get people to click on it in the first place that appeals to the person. They read the summary, if at all,
yep,
and say, oh, this is great, share it. And they have not read what's beneath the summary at all.
Turns out, in this case, there wasn't much of a summary at all other than an image that says, you know, sort of lampooning the whole thing is not real. And we can't even get there. We can't even get people to click through that. People just want to share something that confirms what they're already thinking. So,
that could be a Facebook meme. You could what you could do is you could put up a fake headline, and then anyone who clicks through the link says this was clearly shared by someone who doesn't read what they share.
Oh, see, that's the that's the next generation of Rickrolling.
Yeah, I guess
there. Danielle, you're giving us an idea there. Keith, next up, go ahead, Keith.
Hey, Evan. The easiest way to solve this is if you're an adult, don't even bother going on Facebook, because it basically serves no purpose. If for one day, nobody posted anything, it would die a natural death. My attorney advised me don't go on Facebook because he's seen too many adult problems arise by posting pictures. If you want to have a group together, you can group text, you can call me, you can email me. But I haven't been on Facebook probably about 8 months. And guess what? I'm still alive, and I don't see these endless drivel of inaccurate information.
Okay, well.
They are right. They would post stuff that made no sense, and you have to go to Snoop's to check it, and then you post back. And, you know, what a waste of time.
Thank you, Keith. Mike Johansson is probably the guy. If there's somebody to take up for... Is there a good reason for Facebook these days, Mike? Are you...
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, Facebook serves all kinds of good purposes. And if the people posting trash and garbage and things you don't want to hear are a problem, don't follow them. Don't connect with them. And that's the simple solution. I can't tell you, as someone who lives halfway around the world from a good chunk of his family, how good Facebook is a way for keeping in touch. You know, sharing family moments, that kind of thing. There's a lot of good... comes out of social media and things like Facebook and Twitter. I think where people get into trouble is the feeling that if I belong to Facebook or Twitter, I saw anyone who connects with me, I have to connect with them. Anyone who comments to me, I have to comment back. And it's, think of it a bit as a social function. If someone comes up to you and they're obnoxious, why would you respond to them? Why would you even have anything to do with them? Just disconnect from them.
Hmm. Well, let's see what Jack in Brighton has to say on the subject. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, I received something recently on a private message from Facebook from a long-term friend now living in California, and she was concerned. She had come across something about poison perfume samples that were sent through the mail to unsuspecting recipients by terrorists. And it turned out to be a really old story around the time there was the first anthrax events. I checked it out in Snopes, and I put something on Facebook without mentioning her name. I thought, you know, she was well-intentioned, and she was probably very deeply concerned. And to be honest, my first reaction was, maybe I should warn my landlady if this is true, because she probably would be more likely to open a perfume sample than myself. But anyway, I put the link to Snopes, and I highly recommend it. I think also PolitiFact will clear up questions of whether Trump, you know, spoiler alert, Trump actually lies a lot more than Clinton ever, you know, especially in the Pants on Fire column. So I would recommend people go on PolitiFact if they have any questions about who's lying and about what.
Well, Jack, thanks for the phone call. When it comes to, just think about this, when it comes to the idea that terrorists are sending some kind of chemical weapons attack through the news, through the mail in the form of perfume samples, you're probably not going to first hear about it through an obscure Facebook news link. I don't think. I could be wrong.
Well, this kind of thing's been, honestly, this all predates social media. It's just that these things used to go around in the form of letters, chain letters. They used to go around. I mean, the most bizarre thing that ever happened to me is my wife and I took defensive driving course, 15 or 20 years ago, just to lower our insurance rates. And the instructor was telling an urban legend as though it were true. And I went into the library and researched. And this urban legend had been around since the 1930s.
Was it the high beamer story?
No, it's when you're at a gas station and you're filling up gas and someone gets into your car and as you drive away they slit your throat.
Oh,
you
know. Boy, oh boy!
And this one, and
he was actually an instructor was telling you this.
A sheriff friend had told him.
Wow.
So I pointed this out to him. He said he believed the story to be true and would keep telling it. So then I called the AAA through whom I was getting my defensive driving training. And said, this person's telling stuff that's not true. Mm. So it predates social media. It's been around forever. It just spreads a lot faster now.
Mike Johansson is one of our guests. You're hearing him there. He's a senior lecturer of communication at RIT and a social media consultant at Fixitology Online. Jebo Luo is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Rochester. I'm late for our only break, and I want to also talk about Jebo's research in terms of the topical interest, the subject interest, the issue interest of, for example, of Trump supporters, and whether his research tracks with what our assumptions and stereotypes would be. We're going to get to that, but I know there are other phone calls as well. You've touched some nerves, gentlemen. So if you're on the phone waiting, Don in Amherst, Craig in Brighton, we're going to get back to you after the only break of the hour right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections. It's election day, of course. And first hour, we talked to voters who decided they are not voting this time around, sitting it out on purpose, why they're doing that. Then in the second hour, we're talking about the city of Rochester's forthcoming climate action plan. What's in the plan? How does it compare to other cities that have gotten a lot of attention, like Portland? We'll take a look. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get Don in Amherst first up. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, this is Don Guggenheim. I've actually been on the show.
Yes, Don.
I'm on my way home from the science teachers conference, and you made me pull off at 490 to call in.
Very good.
I just wanted to draw attention to the fact that at the New York State Science Teachers Conference, which just ended an hour and a half ago, I actually did a couple of workshops for teachers on teaching about logical fallacies and cognitive bias. And they are, the people in the audience anyway, were very interested in the information and anxious to get more, and we're working on some resources for helping school teachers teach about that at the Paleontological Research Institution. And I forgot the other thing I was going to say, but interesting show, and I'd like to hear comments on that, I guess.
Hey, Don, real quick, let me just ask you then. Are you optimistic that when it comes to issues like confirmation bias and belief formation, that are we going to move in a direction where it's more mainstream to teach this at younger ages?
I think so. I think there's real interest, although I remember the second piece I was going to say, and that's actually that social media actually, I think, is effective platform for teaching some of this stuff more so than a typical classroom, because those relationships last a long time on Facebook. So you can work on the issues over years instead of over a semester or a year. And I do think, though, that there are at least some teachers are very interested in building the skills for paying attention to cognitive biases and logical fallacies and other traps that help you believe things that just aren't true.
I'm glad to hear someone like you is optimistic on this, Don. Thank you for the phone call. Mike, he says Facebook and social media can be a good tool because of the long-term relationships to kind of work on these issues. What do you think?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And possibly, I'm not aware of this happening, but there would be ways that teachers could start Facebook groups for groups of students or a cohort of students going through school where they could stay in touch with each other and sort of act as each other's, watching each other's backs in terms of what's being shared, what's being said, and that kind of thing, sure.
Okay. Jaybo, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with what Mike said. I was going to move to a slightly different topic.
Sure.
Which will lead into your question. I think other than being an information source for individuals, as researchers in computer science, we look at the social media as a very, very valuable source of doing what's now called computational social science. That being, instead of, the empirical studies employed by traditional social science, you get, 20 people, 100 people at the most, or 1,000 people. Now we can look at millions of people all at once and know what they are thinking, what their opinions are. And that's is particularly valuable for analyzing the election.
And when it comes to this election, there are some stereotypes out there about, well, Clinton voters are likely to gravitate towards these issues. Trump voters would gravitate toward these issues. What did you find, especially on the Trump side?
Yeah, so I think based on looking at the over 10 million followers of Trump, we found out among the top 10 issues that most of the candidates like to talk about, Trump gets a lot of likes, being people like what they say, or his followers like what they say, on issues like ISIS, Iran, immigration, and so on. And in contrast, Hillary gets a lot of nod on women issues, domestic issues. So there is a quite big contrast there.
Did you find any difference when it comes to actual interaction with followers, people online, in terms of are they just liking or are they engaging in a discussion? Is there any back and forth at all?
So in our study, because we're dealing with millions of users, we didn't track everything. So we tracked mostly likes and retweets. But retweet is kind of ambiguous because you like something, you may retweet. You don't like something, you may also retweet. Mm-hmm. But likes is definitely a metering for favoring certain candidate or issues. So that's what we got. In terms of discussions, we didn't do it this time, but we did it 4 years ago for the 2012 election. We look at the social images of the candidates. And then we also analyzed the sentiments of the comments. So there, like each image gets thousands of people to comment on, and then we can aggregate the sentiment of the people who comment and get a better sense of the opinion of the general public. But for this year, we didn't do it because of the sheer volume of data we have to track.
Yeah, there is a lot of data there.
Yeah.
Listeners, you want to weigh in on any of these subjects, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and I'm going to get back to Craig in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Craig.
Oh, hi, Evan. Yeah, my question asked the panelist about what the susceptibility to fear might have to do with the proliferation of fake news. You know, I'm thinking about historically, like when Orson Welles was, reading from War of the Worlds and people thought it was true. And I thumbed through a coffee table book of Nazi propaganda, and it's, and, you know, their propaganda posters, their art, basically, and just the case they built against the Jews was like a 10-year case, and it was filled with fake news. It was all, it was like a large part of their campaign was about fake news about the Jews. And then about our own Red Scare, you know, we're good people. We're duped by you know, by what would come off as news. I'm just wondering about, you know, now we're in a pretty fearful time, too, and if that has anything to do with this proliferation, in addition to sort of how easy it is to spread the news on social media, but is there any connection, you think?
It's a great question, Craig, and let me just start by saying when you think about the issues that Jabo just mentioned as the main issues of concern for Trump voters, ISIS, immigration,
Iran.
There's no way you could say that there's not any legitimate concern about those issues. But at the same time, there's a lot of misinformation out there regarding just how safe or unsafe the world is. This is the safest the world has ever been in terms of violence, safest it's ever been for police officers in this country. Violence and murder is way down in this country. I know there are some urban centers, some outliers, Washington, Chicago, where that's not the case. But in general, we don't often hear about those developments. That doesn't mean it is perfect. My goodness, it's not. Of course not. And it doesn't mean that it's equal for everyone in terms of what is safe and what is not. But I wonder if Craig's point tracks with what Jabo found in terms of the issues that drive some voters' thoughts, and then so the way we kind of share information or at least respond to information. People who are scared of something seem, Mike Johansson, more likely to share it. I see a lot of parents who are scared of vaccines sharing conspiracy theories about autism and other things because they have a legitimate concern or you know, they're genuinely scared about what could happen. Do you think he's right? Do you think Craig's right that fear drives a lot of this?
Well, I think fear does, but I think the difficulty is people not being able to filter, and so that things like social media can magnify those fears. In other words, you see a couple of posts about vaccines and the possible dangers of vaccines, and all of a sudden you have this lingering fear. You do a little research, you find there are other people who think the same way you do. Then you find a quote-unquote news story for a research study that supports your idea, and you share it. And so the fear builds on the fear. It becomes a self-feeding monster, if you like.
Okay. Jabo, what do you think?
I agree with what Mike said. I remember we did another study on during the Ebola outbreak. Mm-hmm. I distinctly remember that CNN did a poll at the peak of this outbreak that 50% of U.S. population thinks they're going to get Ebola. That's just absurd, but that's what people believe. Yeah. So I think this fear factor is not just with social media. But with Ebola, I think people get the news from mainstream media. I think it's just fear, anger tend to get spread much faster, as some of the study already found out. So I don't think social media is necessarily unique in that regard.
Yeah, I can recall, interesting, you bring up Ebola. I recall a friend sharing a story that an entire small town in Texas was quarantined for Ebola, and that look what's happening, it's coming your way. Of course, it was not true, but it was shared with this trepidation that you better take a look at this, look what's coming your way. And I think it was, you know, again, it's a good faith effort. You know, when people are scared, they may think it's important that I share this. What Jabo and Mike are saying there, and I think Craig's phone call, will remind me the next time I feel some kind of fear, be even more willing to vet, be even more willing to kind of wade in and figure out what we're reading, what we're seeing in front of us. Peter in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi. I'm a bankruptcy attorney, and last month a friend of mine sent me a story because of my area, and the headline was 60% of NBA players file for bankruptcy in 5 years after their retirement. And it was kind of a juicy hook, wouldn't you think? And that's why it seemed to have spread around. It actually started not as an internet rumor, but as a newspaper report. And it was just copied from one newspaper to another to another. But as you've been saying, whenever you hear something that sounds too good to be true, well, maybe it isn't. And so I did some research. I found the origin of this particular story came from a reliable source, Sports Illustrated, in 2009. The reporter then had come up with this figure basically by asking around. So he asked, you know, managers and heads of teams, you know, about this issue, and that's where this 60% of NBA players came across. Well, years later, somebody did a study on the subject and found that actually 15% of NBA players filed bankruptcy within 12 years of leaving the league. And so I thought, you know, this is a good example of something that, well, you know, it sounds very enticing, and we have a lot of stereotypes about, well, if we're talking about the NBA, we imagine a certain type of NBA player, which may be a different background from our own. We may imagine that such NBA players would be susceptible to, you know, financial mismanagement and filing bankruptcy. And so we take a story that is pretty outrageous, and we find it irresistible. What do you think?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I'll start with Mike Johansson. What do you think, Mike?
Sure, it has all the great ingredients: celebrity, money, and something that seems to conform to what we believe the world is.
And what's the old saw that it takes that a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth has got its shoes on?
Yeah,
you know, something. Did I just mangle that? I think it's something like that. Anyway,
something.
Jaybo, what do you think?
I think, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think people, other researchers have done this study about Facebook and other social media, that anger, fear-related news or events tend to get spread much faster. Mm. I think that's part of human nature, that, you know, we tend to get afraid, or we are, or maybe not necessarily afraid for ourselves, but maybe for others. So we you know, we bite on these sort of things. I don't have a good solution other than say, as researchers, journalists, we should highlight the necessity to vet all kinds of news you see every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's probably a survival technique too. And going back to the days when the saber-toothed tigers were after us, paying attention to things that you're afraid of was probably a survival technique.
Yeah.
Noticing the pretty daisies could come later.
That's a good point. Just evolution. Sandy and Mendon, we got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Sandy.
I was calling because I canvass a lot of the party. And when I go from house to house, it could be 10 houses down or 10 neighborhoods over, people will say they're against what I'm there for, and they will have exactly the same words. And they will quote it as though they're saying their own opinion rather than really saying their own opinion. I just hear the same thing over and over and over. And it doesn't matter. I mean, I can be any place in the large area that I canvass. It's just strange to me that everybody has the same exact voice.
Well, and to your point there, here's David. An email says, I've confronted many regarding inaccurate posts on Facebook and have been met with significant resistance. They often reply with, well, Hillary this, or well, Bill this, or the DNC did this. They appear defensive as opposed to being open to having the conversation. That's from David. Same kind of thing, that we don't welcome new information and thank people for it. And that's another thing that we need to teach early, that saying I don't know is a virtuous thing to say, and embracing new information and new evidence is a wonderful thing to do. Before we go here, we didn't even get to the fact that The Guardian recently wrote about the way sometimes women interact a little differently online than men, because women encounter a lot more vitriol. Female users get a lot more negative feedback in comment sections, in social media, on Twitter. Research conducted by The Guardian also found, after an analysis of 70 million readers' comments, 8 of the 10 most abused journalists were women. So, Jaybo, when you look at the way that Trump-Clinton women exchange went down here, I wonder if you have any just final thoughts to share on the way men and women may interact online, especially in social media, knowing that the abuse may be different and more extreme for women.
I think that's true. We didn't study this abuse issue, but we studied the different language pattern by men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And we find many interesting things. For example, some of the common words, even something like Italy, can mean different things to male and female. So I think when that's what we find out. So when women talk about Italy, they are more talking about vacation and other things. And men, they are more talking about soccer games. So I think this sort of language difference exists. But at the same time, I think the issue you mentioned about women getting more abuses also exists. That's probably a useful topic for us to study.
Yeah, Mike Johansson in 20 seconds. Again, the lesson there is, goodness gracious, just be mindful the way we talk to people, especially the way we would talk to them in person, right?
Well, exactly. The person on the other side of your computer screen is a human being. Be nice.
Mike Johansson is a senior lecturer of communication at RIT and social media consultant. You can find him online, Fixitology, and we always enjoy learning from Mike. Thank you for being here, as always, Mike.
Glad to be here.
And Jay Baluo, interesting stuff, associate professor of computer science at the University of Rochester. Thanks for sharing your research and your insight this day before Election Day.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack as the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Tomorrow's Election Day. Sun comes up Wednesday, no matter what. I'm certain of that, no matter what happens, but we will be here with you tomorrow.